Side 6. Down Below Station by C.J. Cherry. Continuing on page 181. He reckoned their chances if Pell refused evacuation. Reckoned what awaited any Constantine in Union hands. The military would never let him stay behind. He set his hand on Eileen's shoulder, his heart beating fit to break, realizing the possibility of being separated, losing her and the baby. He would be put aboard under arrest if there were an evacuation, the same way as it had happened on other stations, to get vital personnel out of Union hands, people put on whatever ship they could reach. His father, his mother, Pell was their lives, was life itself to his mother, and Emilio and Maliko. He felt sick inside, stationer, out of generations of stationers who had never asked for war. For Eileen, for Pell, for all the dreams they had had, he would have fought, but he did not know where to begin. Part 3. Norway, 1300 hours. Signy had it visual now, the hubbed ring of Pell Station, the distant moon, the bright jewel of down below, cloud swirled. They had long since dumped velocity, moved in with dreamlike slowness compared to their former speed, as the station's smooth shape resolved itself into the chaos of angles its surface was. Freighters were jammed into every berth of the visible side, docking and standby. There was incredible clutter on scan, and they were moving slowly because it took that long for these sluggish ships to clear an approach for them. Every merchanter which had not been swept into Union hands had to be hereabouts, at station, in pattern, or farther out, or hovering off in the deep, just out of system. Graf still had controls, a tedious business now. Unprecedented crowding and traffic. Chaos indeed. She was afraid when she analyzed the growing tautness at her gut. Anger had cooled, and she was afraid with the helplessness she was not accustomed to feel. A wish that by someone very wise, and at some time long ago, other choices had been made, which would have saved them all from this moment and this place, and the choices they had left. Carriers North Pole and Tibet will stand off from station, the notification came from Europe. Assume patrol. That was mortally necessary, and on this particular approach, Signy wished herself and her crew on that assignment. There was bitter choice ahead. She did not look forward to another operation like Russell's Station, where Civ Panic had anticipated the military action for the station's dismantling, mobs at the docks. Her crew had had enough of that. She had, and disliked the thought of letting troops loose on a station when they were in the mood hers were in now. Another message came through. Pell Station advised that it had shifted a number of freighters out of berth to accommodate the warships in one sequence and without immediate neighbors on the docks. The dislodged freighters would be moving to the pattern of the orbiting ships in a direction opposite to their entry of that pattern. Mazian's voice cut in, deep and harsh, a repeated advisement that whatever disruption in the patterns of ships about Pell, if any freighter tried to jump system, they would be blown without warning. Station acknowledged. It was all they could do. Part 4. Pell, Q, 1300 hours. Nothing worked. In Q, nothing ever seemed to. Vasily Kresich punched buttons totally dead, and punched them again, hit the comm unit with the heel of his hand, and still had no response from Station Comm Central. He paced the limits of his small apartment. The breakdowns infuriated him, drove him almost to tears. They happened daily. The water, the fans, the comm, vid, supplies, shortages driving home over and over again the misery of his living, the decay, the pressure of bodies, the senseless violence of people driven mad by crowding and uncertainty. He had the apartment. He had his possessions. He kept these things meticulously in order, scrubbed often and obsessively. The smell of Q clung to him, no matter how he washed, and how diligently he scrubbed the floors and sealed the closet against the pervading smell. It was an antiseptic reek of cheap astringents and whatever chemicals the station used to combat disease and crowding and keep the life support in balance. He paced the floor, tried the comm again, hoping, and it did not work. He could hear commotion outside in the corridor, trusted that Nino Collady and his boys would have things under some control. Hoped so. There were times when he could not get out of queue, in the occasional disturbances, when the gate sealed, and even his council pass did not suffice to make an exception. He knew where he ought to be, outside, restoring order, managing Collady, trying to restrain the queue police from some of their excesses. And he could not go. His flesh cringed at the mere thought of confronting the mobs and the shouting and the hate and the ugliness of Q, of more blood and more things to disturb his sleep. He dreamed of Redding, of others, of people he had known who turned up dead in the corridors or vented. He knew that this cowardice was ultimately fatal. He fought it, knowing where it led, that when once he appeared to come apart, he was lost, and knowing that, there were days when it was difficult to walk those halls, when he felt his courage inadequate. He was one of them, no different from the rest, and given shelter, he did not want to come out of it, did not want to cross even that brief space necessary to reach the security post and the doors. They would kill him, Collady or one of the rival powers, or someone with no motive at all. Someday, in the madness of rumor which swept Q, they would kill him, someone disappointed at an application, someone who hated and found him a symbol of authority. His stomach knotted now every time he opened the door of his apartment. There were questions outside, and he had no answers. There were demands, and he could not meet them. Eyes, and he could not face them. If he went out this day, he had to come back, when the disorder might be worse. He was never permitted out of queue more than one shift at a time. He had tried, tested his credit with them, finally gathered the courage to ask for papers, to ask for release, days after the last disturbance. Asked, knowing it might get back to Collady. Asked, knowing it might cost him his life. And they had denied him. The great, the powerful council of which he was a member would not hear him. He had, Angelo Constantine said, too great a value where he was, privately made a show of pleading with him to stay where he was. He said nothing more of it, fearing it would go more public, and he would not live long after that. He had been a good man, a brave man, once. He had reckoned himself so, at least, before the voyage, before the war, while there was Jen and Rami. He had twice been mobbed in Kew, once beaten senseless. Redding had tried to kill him and would not be the last. He was tired and sick, and Rejuve was not working for him. He suspected the quality of what he had gotten, suspected the strain was killing him. He had watched his face acquire new lines, a hollowed hopelessness. He no longer recognized the man he had been a year ago. He feared obsessively for his health, knowing the quality of medical care they had in Kew, where any medicines were stolen and might be adulterated, where he was dependent on Collady's largesse for drugs, as well as wine and decent food. He no longer thought of home, no longer mourned, no longer thought of the future. There was only today, as horrible as yesterday, and if there was one desire he had left, it was to have some assurance it would not be worse. Again he tried calm, and this time not even the red light came on. Vandals dismantled things in queue as fast as their own repair crews could get them working. Their own crews. It took days to get PEL workmen in here, and some things stayed broken. He had nightmares of such an end for them all, sabotage of something vital by a maniac who did not consider personal suicide enough, the whole section voided. It could be done, in crisis, or at any moment. He paced the floor faster and faster, clenched his arms across his stomach, which hurt constantly when he was under stress. The pain grew, wiping out other fears. He gathered his nerve at last, put on his jacket, weaponless as most of Q was not, for he had to pass checkpoint scan. He fought nausea, setting his hand on the door release, finally nerved himself to step out into the dark, graffiti-marred corridor. He locked the door after him. He had not yet been robbed, but he expected to be, despite Collady's protection. Everyone was robbed. Safest to have little. He was known to have much. If he was safe, it was that what he had belonged to Collady in his men's eyes, that he did, if word of his application to leave had not gotten to their ears. Through the hall and past the guards, Collady's men. He walked onto the dock, among crowds which stank of sweat, and unchanged clothes and antiseptic sprays. People recognized him and snatched at him with grimy hands, asking news of what was happening over in the main station. I don't know yet. Tom's dead in my quarters. I'm on my way to learn. Yes, I'll ask, sir. He repeated it over and over, tearing from one pair of clutching hands to the next, one questioner to the other, some wild-eyed and far gone in the madness of drugs. He did not run. Running was panic. Panic was mobs. Mobs were death. And there were the section doors ahead, the promise of safety, a place beyond which Q could not reach, where no one could go without the precious pass he carried. It's Mazian. The rumor was running Q dockside. And with it, they're pulling out, all Pels pulling out and leaving us behind. Councillor Kresich. A hand caught his arm and met business. The grip pulled him abruptly about. He stared into the face of Sax Chambers, one of Kaledi's men, felt threat in the grip which hurt his arm. Going where, Councillor? Other side, he said, breathless. They knew. His stomach hurt the more. Council will be meeting in the crisis. Tell Kaledi. I'd better be there. No telling what Council will hand us otherwise. Sax said nothing. Did nothing for a moment. Intimidation was a skill of his. He simply stared, long enough to remind Kresich that he had other skills. He let go, and Kresich pulled away. Not running. He must not run. Must not look back. Must not make his terror evident. He was composed on the outside, though his belly was tied in knots. A crowd was gathered about the doors. He worked his way through them, ordered them back. They moved, sullenly, and he used his pass to open their side of the access, stepped through quickly, and used the card to seal the door before any could gather the nerve to follow. For a moment, then, he was alone on the upward ramp, the narrow access in bright light and a lingering smell of Q. He leaned against the wall, trembling, his stomach heaving. After a moment, he walked on down the ramp on the other side and pressed the button which should attract the guards on the other side of Q line. This button worked. The guards opened, accepted his card, and noted his presence in Pell proper. He passed decontamination, and one of the guards left his post to walk with him, routine, whenever the councillor from Q was admitted to station, until he had passed the limits of the border zone. Then he was allowed to walk alone. He straightened his clothes as he went, trying to shed the smell and the memory and the thoughts of Q. But there was alarm sounding, red lights blinking in all the corridors, and security personnel and police were everywhere evident. There was no peace this side, either. Part 5. Pell, Station Central, Comm Central Office, 1300 hours. The boards in Central Comm were lit from end to end, jammed with calls from every region of the station at once. Residential use had shut itself down in crisis. Situation Red was flashing in all zones, advising all residents to stay put. They were not all regarding that instruction. Some halls of the halls on monitor were vacant. Others were full of panicked residents. What showed now on Q monitor was worse. Security call, John Lucas ordered, watching the screens. Blue 3. The division chief leaned over the board and gave directions to the dispatcher. John walked over to the main board, behind the harried comm chief's post. The whole of council had been called to take whatever emergency posts they could reach, to provide policy, not specifics. He had been closest, had run, reaching this post, through the chaos outside. Hale, he fervently hoped, had done what he was told, was sitting in his apartment with Jessad. He watched the confusion in the center, paced from board to board, watched one and another hall in confusion. The comm chief kept trying to call through to the station master's office, but even he could not get through. Tried to route it through station command comm, and kept getting a channel unavailable blinking on the screen. The chief swore, accepted the protests of his subordinates, a harried man in the eye of a crisis. "What's happening?" John asked. When the man ignored the question for a moment to handle a subordinate's query, he waited. "What are you doing?" "Councillor Lucas," the chief said in a thin voice, We have our hands full. There's no time. You can't get through. No, sir, I can't get through. They're tied up with command transmission. Excuse me. Let it foul, he said, when the supervisor started to turn back to the board, and when the man looked at him, startled. Give me general broadcast. I need the authorization, the comm chief said. Behind him, red lights began to flash and multiply. It's the authorization I need, counselor. Station master has to give it. Do it. The man hesitated, looked about him as if there were advice to be had from some other quarter. John seized him by the shoulder and faced him to the board while more and more lights flashed on the jammed boards. Hurry it, John ordered him, and the chief reached for an internal channel and punched in a mic. General override to number one, he ordered, and had the acknowledgement back in an instant. Override on vid and comm. The comm center main screen lit, camera active. John drew a deep breath and leaned into the field. The image was going everywhere, not least to his own apartment, to the man named Jessad. This is Counselor John Lucas, he said to all Pell, breaking into every channel, operations and residential, from the station's busy directing incoming ship to the barracks of Q, to the least and greatest residence in the station. I have a general announcement. The fleet presently in our vicinity is confirmed to be that of Mazian, proceeding in under normal operations for docking. This station is secure, but will remain under condition red until the all-clear is given. Operations in the comm center and elsewhere will proceed more smoothly if each citizen will refrain from use of communications except in the most extreme necessity. All points of the station are secure, and there has been no damage or crisis. Records will be made of calls, and failure to regard this official request will be noted. All downer work crews, report to your section habitats at once, and wait for someone to direct you. Stay off the docks. All other workers continue about your assigned business. If you can solve problems without calling Central, do so. As yet, we have nothing but operations contact with the fleet. As soon as information becomes available, we will make it public. Please stay by your receivers. This will be the quickest and most accurate source of news. He leaned out of the field. The warning lights went off the console camera. He looked about him to find the chaos on the boards much less, as the whole station had been otherwise occupied for a moment. Some calls returned at once, presumably necessary and urgent. Most did not. He drew a deep breath, thinking in one part of his mind of what might be happening in his apartment, or worse, away from it, hoping that Jessad was there, and fearing that he would be discovered there. Mazian. Military presence, which might start checking records, asking close questions, and to be found harboring Jessad. Sir, it was the comm chief. The third screen from the left was alight. Angelo Constantine, angry and flushed. John punched the call through. Use procedures, Angelo spat and broke off. The screen went dark as John stood clenching his hands and trying to reckon whether that was because he had caught Angelo with no good answer or because Angelo was occupied. Let it come, he thought, in an access of hate, the pulse pounding in his veins. Let Mazian evacuate all who would go. Union would come in after, would have need of those who knew the station. Understandings could be reached. His understanding with Jessad paved the way for that. It was no time to be timid. He was in it, and there was no retreat now. The first step, to become visible, a reassuring voice, and let Jessad see him doing it. Become known, have his face familiar all over the station. That was the advantage the Constantines had always had, monopoly of public visibility, handsomeness. Angelo looked the vital patriarch. He did not. He had not the manner, the lifelong habit of authority. But ability, that he had, and once his heart had begun to settle out of the initial dread of a disorder out there, he found advantage in the disorder, in any event that went against the Constantines. Only Jessad. He remembered Mariner, which had died when Mazian had crowded in on the situation there. Only one thing protected them now, that Jessad had to rely on him and on Hale as his arms and legs, having no network yet of his own, and at the moment Jessad was neatly imprisoned, having to trust him, because he dared not try the halls without papers, dared not to be out there with Mazian coming in. He drew in a breath, expanded with the thought of the power he actually had. He was in the best of positions. Jessag could provide insurance, or what was another body vented, another paperless body, as they sometimes ended up vented out of queue. He had never killed before, but he had known from the time he accepted Jessad's presence that it was a possibility. Chapter 2. Norway, 1400 hours. It was a slow process to berth in so many ships, Pacific first, then Africa, Atlantic, India. Norway received clearance, and Signy, from her vantage at the post central to the bridge, passed the order to Graf at controls. Norway moved in with impatient dispatch, having waited so long, with opening the ports of Pell dock crews to attach the umbilicals while Australia began its move, was completing secure for stay while the supercarrier Europe glided into dock, disdaining the pushed assist which station wanted to give. "Doesn't look like trouble here," Graf said. "I'm getting it all quiet on dockside. Station master security is thick out there. No sign of panicked civs. They've got the lid on it." That was some comfort. Signy relaxed slightly, beginning to hope for sanity, at least while the fleet sorted out its own business. "Message," Calm said then. "General Hale from Pell Station Master to Fleet at dock. Welcome aboard, and will you come to Station Council at earliest?" "Europe will respond," she murmured, and in a moment Europe's comm officer did so, requesting a small delay. "All captains," she heard at last on the emergency channel she had been monitoring for hours, Mazian's own low voice. "Private conference in the briefing room at once. Leave all command decisions to your lieutenants and get over here." "Graf." She hurled herself out of her cushion. "Take over. Die. Get me 10 men for escort. Double quick." Other orders were pouring over comm from Europe, from the deployment of 50 troopers from each ship to dockside, full combat rig, for passing fleet command to Australia's second, Jan Mayus, for the interim, for riders of docked ships to apply to station control for approach instructions to come in for reattachment. Coping with those details was Graf's job now. Mazian had something to tell them. Explanations. Long awaited. She went to her office, delayed only to slip a pistol into her pocket, hastened to the lift and out into the access corridor amid the rush of troops Graf was ordering to the dockside. Combat rigged from the moment they had gone into station approach, headed for the hatch before the echoes of Graf's voice had died in Norway's steel corridors. Di was with them, and her own escort sorted itself out and attached itself as she passed through. The whole dock was theirs. They poured out at the same moment as troops from other ships hit the dockside, and station security faded back in confusion before the businesslike advance of armored troops, who knew precisely the perimeter they wanted and established it. Dock workers scrambled this way and that, uncertain where they were wanted. "Get to work," Di Jantz shouted. "Get those water lines over here." And they made up their minds at once, little threat from them, who were standing too close and too vulnerable compared to the troops. Signy's eyes were for the armed security guards beyond the lines, at their attitude, and at the shadowed tangles of lines and gantries which might shelter a sniper. Her detachment surrounded her, with Bien as officer. She swept them with her, moving rapidly up the row of ship berths, where a mob of umbilicals and gantries and ramps stretched as far as the eye could see up the ascending curve of the dock, like mirror reflections impeded only by the occasional arch of a section seal and the upward horizon. Merchanters docked beyond them. Troops made themselves a screen all along the route between Norway and Europe. She followed after Australia's Tom Edger and his escort. The other captains would be at her back, coming as quickly as they could. She overtook Edger on the ramp up to Europe's access. They walked together. Q of India caught them up when they had passed the ribbed tube and reached the lift, and Pori of Africa was hard on Q's heels. They said nothing, each of them gone silent, perhaps with the same thoughts and the same anger. No speculations. They took only a pair apiece of their guards, jammed the lift car and rode up in silence, walked down the main level corridor to the council room, steps ringing hollowly up here, in corridors wider than Norway's, everything larger scaled. Deserted. Only a few Europe troops stood rigid guard here. The council room likewise was empty. No sign of Mazian, just the bright lights of the room ablaze to tell them that they were expected at that circular table. Outside, Signy bade her escort as the others went. She and the others took their seats by precedence of seniority, Tom Edger first, herself, three vacancies, then Q and Pori. Sung of Pacific arrived, ninth among the chairs. Atlantic's Kreshoff arrived, settled into the number four seat by Signy's other side. "Where is he?" Kreshoff asked finally, at the end of patience. Signy shrugged and folded her arms on the table, staring across at Sung without seeing him. Haste, and then wait. Pulled out of battle, kept in long silence, and now wait again to be told why. She focused on Sung's face, on a classic aged mask which never admitted impatience, but the eyes were dark. Nerves, she reminded herself. They were exhausted, had been yanked out of combat through jump into this. Not a time to make profound or far-reaching judgments. Mazian came in finally, quietly, passed them and took his place at the head of the table, face downcast, haggard as the rest of them. Defeat? Signy wondered, with a knot in the pit of her stomach, like something which would not digest. And then he looked up, and she saw that small tautness about Mazian's mouth and knew otherwise, sucked in her breath with a flare of anger. She recognized the little tension, a mask. Conrad Mazian played parts, staged his appearances as he staged ambushes and battles, played the elegant or the coarse by turns. This was humility, the falsest face of all, quiet dress, no show of brass. The hair, that silver of rejuve, was immaculate, the lean face, the tragic eyes. The eyes lied most of all, facile as an actor's. She watched the play of expressions, the marvelous fluidity that would have seduced a saint. He prepared to maneuver them. Her lips drew tight. "You all right?" he asked them. "All of you." "Why were we pulled out?" she asked forthwith, surprised at direct contact from those eyes, a reflection of anger in return. "What can't go over calm?" She never questioned, had never objected to an order of Mazians in her whole career. She did now, and watched the expression go from anger to something like affection. "All right," he said. "All right." He slid a glance around the room. Again there were seats vacant. They were nine, with two out on patrol. The glance centered on each of them in turn. "Something you have to hear," Mazian said. "Something we have to reckon with." He pushed buttons at the console before his seat, activated the screens on the four walls, identical. Signy looked up at the schematic they had last seen at Omicron Point, the taste of bile in her mouth, watched the area widen, familiar stars shrinking in wider scale. There was no more company territory. It was not theirs anymore, only Pell. On wider view they could see the hinder stars, not Sol. But that was in the reckoning too now. She knew well enough where it was if the schematic kept widening. It froze, ceased to grow. "What is this?" Kreshoff asked. Mazian only let them look. Long. "What is this?" Kreshoff asked again. Signy breathed. It took a conscious effort in that silence. Time seemed at a halt, while Mazian showed them in dead silence what was graven in their minds already. They had lost. They had ruled there once, and they had lost. "From one living world," Mazian said, almost a whisper. "From one living world of our beginning, humankind reached out as far as we've ever gone. One narrow reach of space here, thrust far back from what Union has, the hinder stars, Pell, and the hinder stars, tenable, and with the personnel overloading Pell, possible." "And run again?" Pori asked. A muscle jerked in Mazian's jaw. Signy found her heart beating hard and her palm sweating. It was close to falling apart, all of it. "Listen," Mazian hissed. Mask dropped. "Listen." He stabbed another button. A voice began to speak, distant, recorded. She knew it, knew the foreign inflection, knew it. "Captain Conrad Mazian," the recording began. "This is Second Secretary Sigist Ayres of the Security Council, authorization code Omar Series 3, with authority of the Council and the Company. Ceasefire. Cease fire. Peace is being negotiated. As earnest of good faith, require you cease all operations and await orders. This is a company directive. All efforts are being made to guarantee safety of company personnel, both civilian and military, during this negotiation. Repeat, Captain Conrad Mazian, This is Second Secretary Sigist Ayres. The voice died abruptly with the push of a key. Silence lingered after it. Faces were stark with dismay. "War's over," Mazian whispered. "War's over. Do you understand?" A chill ran through Signy's blood. All about them was the image of what they had lost, the situation in which they were cast. "Companies finally showed up to do something," Mazian said. "To hand them this." He lifted a hand to the screens, a gesture which included the universe. "I recorded that message relayed from the Union flagship. That message. From Seb Azov's flagship. Do you understand? The code designation is valid. Mallory, those company men who wanted passage, that's what they've done to us." She drew in her breath. All warmth had fled. "If I'd taken them aboard..." "You couldn't have stopped them, you understand. Company men don't make solitary decisions. It was already decided elsewhere. If you'd shot them on the spot, you couldn't have stopped it, only delayed it." "Until we'd drawn a different line," she replied. She stared into Mazian's pale eyes and recalled every word she had spoken with Ayres, every move, every intonation. She had let the man go to do this. "So they got their passage somehow," Mazian said. "The question is what agreement they've made first, Appel, and just how much they've signed over to Union. There's the possibility, too, that those so-named negotiators aren't intact. Mind-wiped, they'd sign and say right into Union's anxious fingers, knowing the company signal codes, and no knowing what else they spilled, no knowing what codes, what information, what was compromised, how much of everything they've handed over, our internal codes. No, but we don't know what other Appel codes went. All the kind of thing that would let them come right in here. That's why they abort. Months of planning, yes. Stations gone. Ships and friends gone. Vast human suffering. All of that for nothing. But I had to make a fast decision. The fleet is intact. So is Pell. We've got that much, right or wrong. We could have won at Viking and gotten ourselves pinned there, lost Pell, all source of supply. That's why we pulled out." There was not a sound, not a move. It suddenly made full sense. "That's what I didn't want on comm," Mazian said. "It's your choice. We're at Pell, where we have a choice. Do we assume it's company men who sent that, in their right minds, unforced? That Earth still backs us? It's in question. But, old friends, does that really matter?" "How matter?" Sung asked. "Look at the map, old friend. Look at it again. Here. Here is a world. Pell. And does a power survive without it? What is Earth but that? You have your choice here. Follow what may be company orders, or we hold here. Gather resources. Take action. Europe staying, regardless of orders. If enough do, we can make Union think twice about putting its nose in here. They don't have crews that can fight our style of fight. We've got supply here. We have resources. But make up your minds. I won't stop you. Or you can stay and do what I think you might do. And when history writes what happened to the company out here, it can write what it likes about Conrad Mazian. I made my choice." "Two of us," Edger said. "Three," Signy said, no faster than the murmur from the others. Mazian passed a slow glance from one to the other, nodded. "Then we hold here. But we have to take it. Maybe we'll have cooperation here, and maybe we won't. We're going to find out. And we're not all in on this yet. Soon, I want you personally to go out to North Pole and Tibet and put it to them. Explain it any way you like. And if there's any large number of dissenters in any crew or among the troops, we'll give them our blessing and let them go. Take one of the merchanter ships here and ship them out. I leave it to individual captains to handle that." "There won't be any dissent," Q said. "If there are," Mazian said. "The station now. We move out and disperse our own security throughout. Put our own personnel in key spots. Half an hour is enough for you to break this to your own commands. Whatever they ultimately decide to do, there's no question that we need to hold Pell securely before we can take any action, either to clear a ship for some to leave or to hold on to it." "Go?" Krishov asked when silence lingered. "Go," Mazian said softly, dismissing them. Signy pushed back and moved, first after Sung, past Mazian's own security at the door, gathered her two-man escort and went, aware of others hard at her heels. Uncertainty still weighed at her conscience. She had been company all her life, cursed it, hated its policies and its blindness, but she felt suddenly naked standing outside it. Timidity, she reasoned with herself. She was a student of history, valued the lessons of it. The worst atrocities began with half-measures, with apologies, compromising with the wrong side, shrinking from what had to be done. The deep and its demands were absolutes, and the compromise the company had come to the beyond to try would not hold longer than the convenience of a stronger, and that was union. They served Earth, she persuaded herself, better by what they did than the company agents did by what they traded away. Chapter 3, Part 1, Pell, Sector White 2, 1530 hours. The warning lights must still be on outside in the corridor. The salvage center kept to a deliberate pace. The supervisor walked the aisles between the machines and silenced any talk by his presence. Josh carefully kept his head down, unfastened a plastic seal from a small, worn-out motor, dropped it into a tray for further sorting, dropped clamps into yet another tray, dissembled the components into varied categories for reuse or recycling according to wear and type of material. There had been, since the original comm announcement, no further word from the screen on the forward wall. No discussion was allowed after the initial murmur of dismay at the news. Josh kept his eyes averted from the screen and from the station policeman at the door. He was more than 3 hours past his shift's quitting time. They should all have been dismissed, all those on partial. Other workers should have arrived. He had been here over 6 hours. There was no provision for meals here. The supervisor had finally sent out for sandwiches and drinks for them. There was still a cup of ice on the bench in front of him. He did not touch it, wishing to seem completely busy. The supervisor stopped a moment behind him. He did not react, did not break the rhythm of his actions. He heard the supervisor move on and did not look to see. They did not treat him differently from the others here. It was his own troubled mind, he persuaded himself, which made him suspect they might be watching him in particular. They were all closely supervised. The girl by him, a solemn, slow-moving child and ever so careful, was doing the most complex job of which she was capable, and nature had cheated her of much capacity. Many here in the salvage center were of that category. There were some who entered here young, perhaps to seek a track up through the job classifications, to gain elementary mechanical skills and to go higher into technical positions or manufacture. And there were some whose nervous behavior indicated other reasons for being here, anxious, obsessive concentration, strange to observe the symptoms in others. Only he had never been a criminal, as they might have been, and perhaps they trusted him less for that. He cherished his job here, which kept his mind busy, which gave him independence, quite as the sober girl beside him cherished her place, he thought. At first, in his zeal for demonstrating his skill, he had worked with feverish quickness, and then he saw that it upset the child beside him, and that distressed him, because she could not do more, could never do more. He compromised then, and did not make his efficiency obvious. It was enough to survive. It had looked to be enough for a long time. Only now he felt sick to his stomach and wished he had not eaten all his sandwich, but even in that matter he had not wanted to seem different from those about him. The war had gotten to Pell. Mazziani, the fleet, was at hand. Norway and Mallory. He did not think some thoughts. When the dark crowded him, he worked the harder and blinked the memories away. Only, war. Someone near him whispered about having to evacuate the station. It was not possible. It could not happen. Damon, he thought, wishing that he could get up and leave, go to the office, be reassured. Only there was no reassurance to be found, and he was afraid to try it. Mazian's fleet. Martial law. She was with them. He might break if he was not careful. The balance of his mind was delicate, and he knew it. Perhaps to have asked for this oblivion was in itself insane, and adjustment had made him no more unbalanced than he had ever been. He suspected every emotion he felt, and therefore tried to feel as few as possible. "Rest," the supervisor said. 10-minute break." He kept working, as he had through previous rest periods. So did the girl beside him. Part 2. Norway, 15:30 hours. "We hold Pell," Signy told her crew and the troops, those present with her on the bridge, and those scattered throughout the ship. "Our decision, Mazian's, mine, the other captains, is to hold Pell. Company agents have signed a treaty with Union, handed them everything in the beyond, and called for us to stand aside while they do it. They turned our contact code over to Union. That's why we aborted the strike, why we took out. No knowing what of our codes is betrayed." She let that sink in, watching grim faces all about her, aware of the whole body of the ship and all the listeners elsewhere within it. "Pell, the hinder stars, this whole edge of the beyond, this is what we have left secure. We aren't going to take that order from the company. We aren't going to accept surrender, however it's cloaked. We're off the leash, and this time we fight the war our own way. We've got ourselves a world and a station, and the whole beyond began from that. We can rebuild the hinder star stations, all that used to exist between here and the sun itself. We can do it. The company may not be smart enough to want a buffer now between themselves and Union, but they will, believe me, they will, and they'll be smart enough at least not to trifle with us. Pell's our world now. We've got 9 carriers to hold it. We're not company anymore. We're Mazian's fleet, and Pell is ours. Any contrary opinions?" She waited for some, although she knew her people like family. For some might have other opinions, might have second thoughts about this. There was reason they should. A sudden cheer erupted off the troop decks, found echo, all channels open. People on the bridge were hugging one another and grinning. Graf embraced her, Armskamper Taiho did, and others of her officers of many years. Some were crying. There were tears in Graf's eyes, none in her own. Might have been, but that she felt guilt, still, irrationally, the habit of an outworn loyalty. She embraced Graf a second time, pushed back, looked around her. "Get all of us ready," she said. It was going all over the ship, open comm. "We're moving in to take Station Central before they know what's hit them. Di, hurry it." Graf started giving orders. She heard Di doing so down in the troop corridors, distinctive echo. The bridge moved into activity, techs jostling one another in the narrow aisles getting to posts. 10 minutes, she shouted. "Full armament. All available troops, arm and out." There was shouting elsewhere, the comm giving evidence of troops rushing to suit even before the orders were officially passed. The commands began echoing through the corridors. Signy walked back to her small office quarters and took the precaution of helmet and body armor, none for her limbs, trading risk for freedom of motion. 5 minutes. She heard Di counting over the open comm, with outright chaos feeding out from various command stations. No matter. This crew and the troops knew their business in the dark and upside down. All family here. The incompatible met early accidents, and those left were close as brothers, as children, as lovers. She headed out, slipping her pistol openly into the armor holster, rode the lift down. Armored troops pouring down the corridor at a rattling run hit the wall to give her room the instant they recognized her coming through, so that she could run to the fore where she belonged. "Signy!" they cried after her, jubilant. "Bravo, Signy!" They were alive again and felt it. Part 3. Pell Council, Sector Blue 1. "No," Angelo said at once. "No, don't try to stop them. Pull back. Pull back our forces immediately." Station Command acknowledged and turned to its business. Screens in the council chamber began to reflect new orders. The muffled voice of Security Command gave reports. Angelo sank back in his chair at the table in the center of council, amid the partially filled tears, the soft murmurings of panic among those who had contrived to get back here through the halls. He propped his mouth against his steepled hands and sat studying the incoming reports which cut across the screens in rapid sequence, views of the docks where armored troops boiled out. Some of the council had waited too long, could not get out of the sections where they worked or where they had taken up an emergency post. Damon and Aline came in together for refuge, out of breath, hesitated at the door. Angelo beckoned his son and daughter-in-law in on personal privilege, and they approached at his urging and settled at two of the vacant places at the table. Had to leave dock office in a hurry, Damon said quietly. Took the lift up. Hard behind them came John Lucas and his clutch of friends to seat themselves, the friends in the tiers and John at the table. Two of the Jacobis made it, hair disheveled and faces glistening with sweat. It was not council. It was a sanctuary from what was happening outside. On the screens, matters were worsening. The troops headed in toward the heart of the station, security trying to keep up with the situation by remote, switching from one camera to the next in haste, a rapid flickering of images. Staff wants to know if we lock the control center doors, a counselor said from the doorway. Against rifles? Angelo moistened his lips, slowly shook his head, staring at the flick of images from camera to camera to camera. Call Mazian, Dee said, a new arrival. Protest this. I have, sir. I have no answer. I reckon he's with them. Cue disorder, a screen advised them. Three known dead, numerous injured. Sir, a call broke through the message. They're mobbing the doors in queue, trying to batter them down. Shall we shoot? Don't open, Angelo said, his heart pounding at the acceleration of insanity where there had been order. Negative. Don't fire unless the doors are breached. What do you want, to let them loose? No, sir. Then don't. The contact went dead. He wiped his face, feeling ill. I'll get down that way, Damon offered, half out of his chair. You're not going anywhere, Angelo said. I don't want you gathered up in any military sweep. Sir, an urgent voice came at his elbow, a presence which had come down from the tiers. Sir, Kresich. Sir, Kresich said. QCOM is down, Security Command advised. They've got it out again. We can splice something in. They can't have reached the dock speakers. Angelo looked at the man Kresich, a haggard, grayed individual who had gotten more so in the passing months. Hear that? They're afraid, Kresich said, that you're going to leave here and let the fleet leave them for Union. We don't know what the fleet's intention may be, Mr. Kresich, but if a mob tries to breach those doors into our side of the docks, it's going to be beyond our power to do anything but shoot. I suggest you get on the comm link to that section when they get it patched, and if there's a speaker they haven't broken, make that clear to them. We know we're pariahs, whatever happens, Kresich returned, lips trembling. We asked over and over, speed up the checks, run IDs, purify our records, do it faster. Now it's too late, isn't it? Not necessarily, Mr. Kresich. You're going to see to your own people first, get them on the available ships in comfort. You're going to take our ships, Mr. Kresich. Work has been progressing, said John Lucas. Some of you may have clear papers. I wouldn't jeopardize them, sir. There was sudden silence from Kresich, an uncertain look, his face an unwholesome color. His lips trembled, and the tremor spread to his chin, his hands locked upon each other. Amazing, Angelo thought sourly, how easily it comes down to small concerns, and how accurately he does it. Congratulations, John. Easy to deal with the refugees of Q, offer all their leaders clear paper and reason with them. Some had, in fact, proposed that. They've got Blue 3, Damon muttered. Angelo followed his gaze to the monitors, on which the flow of armored troops and their stationing along the corridors had become a rapid mechanical process. Mazian, said John. Mazian himself. Angelo stared at the silver-haired man in a lead, mentally counting off the moments it would take that tide of soldiery to flow up the spiraling emergency ramps to their level, to the doors of the council itself. That long, he still held the station. Part 4. Sector Blue 1, number 0475. The images changed. Lily fretted, sprang up, and walked back and forth, a step toward the buttons on the box, a step toward the dreamer whose eyes were troubled. Finally, she dared reach for the box to change the dream. No, the dreamer told her sharply, and she looked back and saw the pain, the dark, lovely eyes in the pale face, the white, white sheets, all about her light save her eyes, which gazed on the sights in the halls. Lily came back to her, interposed her body between dream and dreamer, smoothed the pillow. I turn you, she offered. No. She stroked the brow, touched so, so gently. Daltesilan, love you, love you. They are troops, son, her friend said, in that voice so still and calm that it shed peace on others. Men with guns, Lily. It's trouble. I don't know what may happen. Dream them gone, Lily pleaded. I have no power to do that, Lily. But see, there is no using the guns. No one is hurt. Lily shivered and stayed close. From time to time on the ever-changing walls, the face of sun appeared, reassuring them, and stars danced, and the face of the world shone for them like the crescent moon. And the line of men in shells grew, filling all the ways of the station. Part 5. There was no resistance. Signy had not drawn her gun, although her hand was on it. Neither had Mazian or Krezhov or Q. Threat was for the troops, leveled rifles with the safeties off. They had fired one warning burst on the docks, nothing since. They moved quickly, giving no time for thought in those who met them now, no hint that there was argument possible. And there were few who lingered to meet them at all in these sections. Angelo Constantine had given orders, Signy reckoned, the only sensible course. They changed levels, up a ramp at the end of the main hall. Boots rang in complete vacancy, the sharp report of troops in their wake filing off to station themselves at the appointed line-of-sight interval set up other echoes. They passed from the emergency ramp to the area of station control. Troops moved in there, too, under officers, lowered rifles, while other detachments headed down the side halls to invade other offices. No shooting, not here. They kept moving down the center corridors, passed from cold steel and plastics to the sound-deadening matting, entered the hall of the bizarre wooden sculptures, whose eyes looked no less shocked now than before. And the human faces, the small group gathered in the anteroom of the council chambers, were as round-eyed. Troopers swept through, pushed at the ornate doors to open them. The lead door swung to either side, and two troopers braced like statues, facing inward, rifles leveled. The councillors inside, in a chamber far from filled, rose and faced the guns as Signy and Mazian and the others walked through. There was dignity in their posture, if not defiance. "Captain Mazian," said Angelo Constantine, "can I offer you to sit and talk this over with us, you and your captains?" Mazian stood still a moment. Signy stood between him and Q, Krezhov on the other side, surveying faces. Not the full council, not by half. "We don't take that much of your time," Mazian said. "You asked us here, so we're here." No one had moved, not to sit, not to shift position. "We'd like an explanation," Constantine said, "of this operation." "Martial law," Mazian said, "for the duration of the emergency. And questions, direct questions, Mr. Constantine, regarding agreements you may have made with certain company agents, understandings with Union, and the flow of classified information to Union intelligence. Treason, Mr. Constantine." Blood left faces all about the room. "No such understandings," Constantine said. "No such understandings exist, Captain. This station is neutral. We are a company station, but we do not permit ourselves to be drawn into military action or used as a base." "And this militia you have scattered about you?" "Sometimes neutrality needs reinforcement, Captain. Captain Mallory herself warned us of random refugee flights. You claim ignorance that information was handed to Union by civilian company agents. You aren't party to any agreements, arrangements, or concessions which those agents may have made with the enemy?" There was a moment of heavy silence. "We know of no such agreements. If there were any agreements to be made, Pell was not informed of them, and if we had been, we would have discouraged them." "You're informed now," Mazian said. "Information was passed, including code words and signals which jeopardized the security of this station. You've been handed to Union Station Master by the company. Earth is folding up its interests out here. You're one. We're another. We don't accept such a situation. Because of what's already been turned over, other stations have been lost. You're the border. With what forces we have, Pell is both necessary to us and tenable. Do you understand me?" "You'll have every cooperation," Constantine said. "Access to your records. Every security problem should be weeded out and set under quarantine." Constantine's eyes shifted to Signy and back again. "We've followed all your procedures as outlined by Captain Mallory, meticulously. There'll be no section of the station, no record, no machine, no apartment, if need be, where my people don't have instant access. I would prefer to withdraw most of my forces and leave yours in charge, if we can have this clearly understood. That if there are security problems, if there are leaks, if a ship bolts from pattern out there, or if order breaks down in any particular, we have our own procedures, and they involve shooting. Is that clear? It is, Constantine said, abundantly clear. My people will come and go at will, Mr. Constantine, and they'll shoot if they judge it necessary, and if we have to come in shooting to clear the way for one of ours, we will, every man and woman in the fleet. But that won't happen. Your own security will see to it, or your security with the help of ours. You tell me which way. Constantine's jaw clenched. So we are playing on both sides, Captain Mazian. We recognize your obligation to protect your forces and to protect this station. We will cooperate. We will expect cooperation from you. When I send a message hereafter, it goes through. Absolutely, Mazian said easily. He looked to right and left of him, moved finally, walked a space toward the doors, while Signy and the others still faced Council. Captain Q, he said, you may discuss matters further with Council. Captain Mallory, take the operations center. Captain Kreshov, check through security records and procedures. I'll want someone knowledgeable, Kreshov said. The security director will assist you, Constantine said. I'll call that order ahead. I also, Signy said, glancing at a familiar face at the central table, the younger Constantine. The young man's expression altered at that look, and the young woman by him reached a hand to his. Captain, he said. Damon Constantine, yourself, if you will, you can be of help. Mazian left, taking a few of the escort with him, for a general tour of the area, or more than likely further operations, the taking of other sections, like the Corps and its machinery. Jan Mayus, Australia's second-in-command, was on that delicate task. Q drew back a chair at the council table, taking possession of it and the chamber. Kreshaw followed Mazian out. Come on, Signy said, and young Damon paused for a glance at his father, who was thin-lipped and upset at parting with the young woman at his side. They did not, Signy reckoned, think much of her company. She waited, then walked with him to the door, where she gathered up two of her own troopers for escort, Kuhn and Decton. The command center, she directed Constantine, and he showed her out the door with incongruous and natural courtesy, tending the way they had come in. Not a word from him. His face was set and hard. Your wife back there? Signy asked. She collected details on those of consequence. Who? My wife. Who? Eline Quinn. That startled her. Station family? The Quinns, off Estelle. Married me and stayed off her last run. She's lost, you know that. We know. Pity. Children, you two? It was a moment before he answered that one. On the way. Ah, the woman had been a little heavy. There are two of you Constantine boys, aren't there? I have a brother. Where is he? On down below. The expression was more and more anxious. There's nothing to worry about. I'm not worrying. She smiled, mocking him. Are your forces on down below, too? He asked. She kept the smile, saying nothing. I recall you're from Legal Affairs. Yes. So you'd know quite a few of the comp accesses for personnel records, wouldn't you? He shot her a look that wasn't frightened, angry. She looked at the corridor ahead, where troops guarded the windowed complex of Central. We're assured your cooperation, she reminded him. Is it true that we were seated? She smiled still, reckoning the Constantines, if anyone, to have their wits about them, to know their value and that of Pell. Trust me, she said with irony. Command Central, a sign said, with an arrow pointing. Communications, another, Blue 1, 01-0122. Those signs, she said, come down, everywhere. Can't. And the color keys. The station is too confusing. Even residents could get lost. The hall's mirror image, and without our color keys. So in my ship, Mr. Constantine, we don't mark corridors for intruders. We have children on this station. Without the colors, they can learn, she said, and the signs all come off. Station Central lay open before them, occupied by troops. Rifles swung anxiously as they entered, then recentered. She looked all about the command center, the row upon row of control consoles, the technicians and station officers who worked there. Troops visibly relaxed at her presence. Sivs at their post looked relieved as well, at that of young Constantine, she reckoned, for that purpose she had brought him. It's all right, Signy said to the troops and to Sivs. We've reached an accommodation with the station master and the council. We're not evacuating Pell. The fleet is setting up a base here, one we're not going to give up. No way Union's coming in here. A murmur went among the Sivs, eyes meeting eyes with subdued looks of relief. From hostages, they were suddenly allies. The troops had grounded their rifles. Mallory, she heard whispered from point to point of the room. That's Mallory. In that tone, which was not love, nor was it disrespect. Show me about, she said to Damon Constantine. He walked about the control center with her, quietly named the posts, the personnel who filled them, many of whom she would remember. She was good at that when she wanted to be. She stopped a moment and looked about her, at the screens, the rotating schematic down below, dotted with green and red points. Bases? She asked. We've got several auxiliary sites, he said, trying to absorb and feed what you left us. Q? She saw the monitor on that section, too, seething human mass battering at a sealed door. Smoke, debris. What do you do with them? You didn't give us that answer, he replied. Few took that tone with her. It amused her. She listened, looked about her at the grand complex, bank upon bank, boards with functions alien to those of a starship. This was commerce and the maintenance of a centuries-old orbit, cataloging of goods and manufacture, of internal and on-world populations, native and human, a colony busy with mundane life. She surveyed it with a slow intake of breath, a sense of ownership. This was what they had fought to keep alive. Comm Central came through suddenly, an announcement from Council. Wish to assure station residents, said Angelo Constantine, with Council chambers in the background, that no evacuation of this station will take place. The fleet is here for our protection. Their world. It only remained to put it in order. Chapter 4. Down below main base, 1600 hours station standard. Local dawn. Note. Seasonal variation in daylight hours and difference in rotational period from station Earth standard results in daily progressing time difference. Station and world pass only rarely into relative sync. End of note. Morning was near, a red line on the horizon. Amelia stood in the open, breath paced evenly through the mask, wearing a heavy jacket against the perpetual chill of nights at this latitude and elevation. The lines moved in the dark, quietly bowed figures hastening with loads like insects saving eggs from flood, outward, out of all the storage domes. The human workers still slept, those in queue and those of the residence domes. Only a few staff helped in this. His eyes could spot them here and there about the landscape of low domes and hills, tall shadows among the others. A small panting figure scurried up to him, gasped a naked breath. Yes? Yes, you send, Constantine men? Bounder? I bounder. The voice hissed around a grin. Good runner, Constantine men. He touched a wiry, furred shoulder, felt a spidery arm twine with his. He took a folder paper from his pocket, gave it into the Hysa's calloused hand. Run, then, he said. Carry this to all human camps. Let their eyes see, you understand? And tell all the Hysa, tell them all, from the river to the plain, tell them all, send their runners, even to Hysa who don't come in human camps. Tell them be careful of men, trust no strangers. Tell them what we do here. Watch. Watch, but don't come near until a call they know. Do the Hysa understand? Lucas has come, the Hysa said. Yes, understand, Constantine, then. I bounder, I am wind, no one catches. Go, he said. Run, bounder. Hard arms hugged him with that frightening, easy strength of the Hysa. The shadow left him into the dark, flitted, ran. Word sped. It could not be recalled, not so easily. He stood still, watched the other human figures on the hillside. He had given his staff orders and refused to confide in them, wishing to spare them responsibility. The storage domes were mostly empty now, all the supplies they had contained taken deep into the bush. Word sped along the river by ways which had nothing to do with modern communications, nothing which listeners could monitor, word which sped with a Hysa speed and would not be stopped at any order from the station or those who held it. Camp to camp, human and Hysa, wherever Hysa were in touch one with the other. A thought struck him, that perhaps never before man had the Hysa had reason to talk to others of their kind in this way, that never to their knowledge was there war, never unity among the scattered tribes, but somehow knowledge of man had gotten from one place to the other. And now human sent a message through that strange network. He imagined it passing on riverbanks and in the brush, by chance meetings and by purpose, with whatever purpose moved the gentle, bewildered Hysa. And over all the area of contact, Hysa would steal, who had no concept of theft, and leave their work, who had no concept of wages or of rebellion. He felt cold, wrapped as he was in layers of clothing, well insulated against the chill breeze. He could not, like Bounder, run away. Being Constantine and human, he stood waiting, while advancing dawn picked out the lines of burdened workers, while humans from the other domes began to stir out of sleep to discover the systematic pilferage of stores and equipment, while his staff stood by watching it happen. Lights went on under the transparent domes. Workers came out, more and more of them, standing in shock. A siren sounded. He looked skyward, saw only the last few stars as yet, but Calm had wind of something. And a presence disturbed the rocks near him, and a slim arm slipped around his waist. He hugged Maliko against him, cherishing the contact. There was a call from across the slope, arms lifted, pointed up. The light of the descending ship was visible in the paling sky, sooner than they had wanted. Minx! He called one of the Hysa to him, and she came, a female with the white blaze of an old burn on her arm, came burdened as she was and panting. Hide now, he told her, and she ran back to the line, chattering to her fellows as she went. Where are they going? Maliko asked. Did they say? They know, he said. Only they know. He hugged her the tighter against the wind. And they're coming back again. That depends on who does the asking. If they take us away, we do what we can, but there'll be no outsiders giving them orders. The light of the ship brightened, intense. Not one of their shuttles, but something bigger and more ominous. Military, Emilio reckoned. A carrier's landing probe. Mr. Constantine, one of the workers came running up, stopped with a bewildered spreading of his hands. Is it true? Is it true that Mazian's up there? We were sent word, that's what it is. We don't know what's going on up there. Indications are things are quiet. Keep it calm, pass the word. We keep our wits about us, ride events as they come. No one says anything about the missing supplies. No one mentions them, you understand? But we aren't going to have the fleet strip us down here and then go off to leave the station to starve. That's what's going on. You pass that word, too. And you take your orders only from me and from Maliko, hear? Sir, the man breathed, and at his dismissal ran off to carry the news. Better put it to Q, Maliko said. He nodded, started that way, from the hillside on which they stood. Over the hill a glow flared up, field lights on to guide the landing. He and Maliko walked the path over to Q, found way there. Fleet's up there, Emilio said, and at the quick, panicked murmur, we're trying to keep food for station and ourselves, trying to stop a fleet takeover down here. You saw nothing. You heard nothing. You're deaf and blind, and you don't have responsibility for anything. I do. There was murmuring from the resident workers from Q. He turned, he and Maliko, headed by the path from there to the landing site. A crowd of his own staff and resident workers formed about him. Q folk, too. No one stopped them. They had no guards anymore, not here, not at the other camps. Q worked by posted schedules like other workers. It was not without its arguments, its difficulties, but they were less a threat than what descended on them all, which would make its demand for provisions, for troop-laden carriers, and possibly demands for live bodies. The ship came down in thunder, settled into the landing area and overfilled it, and on the hillside they stopped their ears in its sound and turned their faces from its reeking wind until the engines had shut down. It rested there in the breaking day, foreign and ungainly and bristling with war. The hatch opened, lowered a jaw to the ground, and armored troops walked down onto the soil of the world as they, on their hillside, stood still in a line of their own, armorless and weaponless. The troops braced, aimed rifles. An officer came down the ramp into the light, a dark-skinned man with a breathing mask only, no helmet. "That's Pori," Malika whispered. "That has to be Pori himself." He felt the burden on himself to go down and answer the posed threat, let go Malika's hand, but she did not let go his. They walked down the hill together to meet the legendary captain, stopped at speaking range, all too conscious of the rifles now much closer to them. "Who's in charge of this base?" Pori demanded. "Emilio Constantine and Malika D., Captain." "Before me?" "Yes, Captain." "Receive a decree of martial law. All supplies at this base are confiscated. All civilian government, human and native, is suspended. You will turn over all records of equipment, personnel, and supplies immediately." Emilio made an ironic sweep of his free hand, offering the domes, plundered domes. Pori would not be amused, he reckoned. Certain hand-kept books had disappeared, too. He was afraid for himself, for Malika, for the men and women of this base and others, not least of all for the Haisa, who had never seen war. "You will remain on this world," Pori said, "to assist us in whatever ways are necessary." Emilio smiled tautly and pressed Maliko's hand. It was a rest, nothing less than that. His father's message, rousing him out of sleep, had given him time. About him were workers who had never asked to be put in this position, who had been volunteered for this service. He relied less on their silence than on the Haisa's speed. It was even possible that the military would put him under more direct restraint. He thought of his family on the station, the possibility of Pell being evacuated, and of Mazian's men making deliberate ruin of down below itself in a pullout, destroying what they did not want Union to get their hands on, impressing all the able-bodied into the fleet. They would put guns in Heise's hands if it would get them lives to throw against Union. "We'll discuss the matter," he answered. "Captain, arms will be turned over to my troops. Personnel will submit to search." "I suggest discussion, Captain." Pori gestured sharply. "Bring them inside." The troops started for them. Maliko's hand clenched on his. He took the initiative and they walked forward on their own, suffered themselves to be spot searched, and brought up the ramp into the glare of the ship's interior where Pori waited. Emilio stopped at the upper end of the ramp with Malika beside him. "We have the responsibility for this base," he said. "I don't want to make public issue of it. Very quietly, I'll comply with reasonable needs of your forces." "You are making threats, Mr. Constantine." "I'm making a statement, sir. Tell us what you want. I know this world. Military intervention in a working system would have to take valuable time to establish its own ways, and in some cases, intervention could be destructive." He stared into Pori's scar-edged eyes, well read that this was a man who did not like to be defied, who was personally dangerous. "My officers will go with you," Pori said, "to get the records." Chapter 5, Part 1. Pell, Sector White 2, 1700 hours. Police had come in, quiet men, who stood by the door and talked to the supervisor. Josh saw them from under his brows and kept his head down, his fingers never missing a turn of the piece he was removing. The young girl by him had stopped outright, nudged him hard in the ribs. "Hey," she said. "Hey, it's police." 5 of them. Josh ignored the blows in his ribs, and she only jabbed him the harder. Above them, the comm screen came on. The light caught his eyes, and he looked up for an instant at another general announcement for the return of limited freedom of passage in Green Section. He ducked his head and resumed work. "They're looking this way," the girl said. They were. They were making gestures in this direction. Josh shot a look up and down again, up once more, for troops had come in, armored. Company soldiers. Maziani. "Look," the girl said. He set himself back to work. The silken voice of Central continued over the comm, promising that it was all safe. He stopped believing it. Footsteps were in the aisle, coming from the other side, heavy steps, and many of them. They reached him and stopped behind him. He kept working in a last feverish hope. Damon, he thought, wished. Damon! A hand touched his shoulder and made him turn. He stared up into the supervisor's face, unfocused, on the security police from the station, and a soldier in the armor and insignia of Mazian's fleet. "Mr. Talley," said one of the police, "will you come with us, please?" He realized the wrench in his hand as a weapon, carefully laid it on the counter, wiped his hands on his coveralls, and stood up. "Where are you going?" the girl beside him asked. He had never known her name. Her plain face was distressed. "Where are you going?" He did not answer, not knowing. One of the police took him by the arm and brought him away down the aisle and up the side of the shop to the door. They were all staring. "Quiet," the supervisor said. There was a general murmuring. The police and the troops brought him outside into the corridor and stopped there. The door closed, and a troop officer, in body armor only, faced him to the wall and searched him. The man took his papers from his pocket. He faced about again when they let him and stood with his back against the wall, watching the officer go through the papers. "Atlantic," their insignia said. A sick terror worked in him. Company soldiers had the papers in their hands, and they were all his claim to harmlessness, proof of what he had been through, that he was no danger to anyone. He reached out to recover them, and the officer held them out of reach. "Mazziani." The shadow came back. He withdrew his hand, remembering other encounters, his heart pounding. "I have a pass," he said, trying to keep the tick from his face, which came when he was upset. "It's with the papers. You can see I work here. I'm supposed to be here." "Mornings only." "We were all held," he said. "We were all held over. Check the others. We're all from morning shift." "You'll come with us," one of the troopers said. "Ask Damon Constantine. He'll tell you. I know him. He'll tell you that I'm all right." That delayed them. "I'll make a note of that," the officer said. "It's possibly true," said one of the station police. "I've heard something like that. He's a special case." "We have our orders. Comp spat him out. We have to clear the matter. You lock him up in your facilities, or we lock him up in ours." Josh opened his mouth to state a preference. "We'll take him," the policeman said before he could plead. "My papers," Josh said. He stammered and flushed with shame. Some reactions were still too much to control. He held out a demanding hand for his papers, and it shook visibly. "Sir." The officer folded them and carefully put them into his belt kit. "He doesn't need them. He's not going anywhere. You take him and put him away, and you have him available if any of us want him. You understand that? He may go into queue later, but not till command's had a chance to review it." "Understood," the policeman said crisply. He seized Josh's arm, led him down the corridor. The troops walked behind, and finally, at an intersection of corridors, their path and that of the troops diverged. But there were Mazziani at every visible hallway. He felt cold and exposed, felt profound relief when the police stopped at a lift and took him into the car alone. They were, for that ride up and around to Red Sector 1, without the troops. "Please call Damon Constantine," he asked one of them, "or Aline Quinn, or anyone in their offices. I know the numbers." There was silence for most of the ride. "We'll report it through channels," one said finally, without looking at him. The lift stopped, Red 1, security zone. He walked out between them, through the transparent partition and to the desk at the entry. Troops were inside this office, too, armored and armed, and that sent a wave of panic through him, for he had hoped that in this place at least he was under station authority. "Please," he said at the desk, while they were checking him in. He knew the young officer in charge. He had been here when he was a prisoner. He remembered. He leaned forward toward him and lowered his voice desperately. "Please call the Constantines. Let them know I'm here." Here, too, there was no answer, only an uncomfortable shift of the eyes away from him. They were afraid, all the stationers, terrified of the armed troops. Soldiers drew him away from the desk, led him down the corridor to the detention cells, put him into one, barren and white, and furnished only with sanitary facilities and a white bench extruded from the walls. They delayed to search him again, strip-searched this time, and left him, his clothing, on the floor. He dressed, sank down finally onto the bench, tucked his feet up and rested his head against his knees, tired from his long working, and knotted up with fear. Part 2. Merchanter ship Hummer, in deep space, 1700 hours. Vittorio Lucas rose from his seat and walked the curve of Hummer's dingy bridge, hesitated at the twitch of a stick in the hand of a Unioner who continually kept an eye on him. They would not let him come within reach of controls, in this tiny, steeply curved rotation cylinder. Most of Hummer's unlovely mass was a null G belly, aft. There was a line on the tiles, marked in tape, which circumscribed his prison. He had not discovered yet what would happen if he crossed it without being called. He never meant to find out. He was allowed most of the circuit of the cylinder, the crew quarters where he slept, the tiny main room section, and this far into the operations area. From here he could make out one of the screens and see scan past the tech's shoulder. He lingered, staring at it, at the backs of men and women in merchanter dress who were not merchanters, his belly still queasy from drugs and his nerves crawling from jump. He had spent most of the day throwing up his insides. The captain was standing, watching the screens, saw him, beckoned him. Vittorio hesitated. At a second signal came walking ahead into that forbidden operations zone, not without a backward glance at the man with the stick. He accepted the captain's friendly hand on his shoulder as he took a closer look at scan. Prosperous-looking sort, this man. Might have been a Pell businessman, urged his crew rather than snapping orders. They all treated him well enough, even with politeness. It was his situation and the potentials in it which had him terrified. Coward, his father would say in disgust. It was true, he was. This was no place and no company for him. "We're moving back soon now," the man said. Blass, his name was, Abe Blass. Didn't jump far, just enough to stay out of Mazian's way. "Relax, Mr. Lucas. Your stomach treating you better now?" He said nothing. The mention of his malaise brought a spasm to his gut. "Nothing's wrong," Blass said softly, hand still on his shoulder. "Absolutely nothing, Mr. Lucas. Mazian's arrival doesn't trouble us." He looked at the man. "And what if the fleet spots us when we come in again?" "We can always jump," Blass said. "Swan's Eye won't have strayed from her post, and Yaliko won't talk. She knows where her interests lie. Just rest easy, Mr. Lucas. You still seem to have some apprehensions of us." "If my father on Pell is compromised..." "That won't be likely to happen. Jessad knows what he's doing, believe me. It's all planned for, and Union takes care of its friends." Blass patted the shoulder. "You're doing very well for a first jump. Take an old-timer's advice and don't push yourself. Just relax. Go on back to the main room, and I'll talk to you as soon as our move-in is plotted." "Sir," he murmured, and did as he was told, wandering past the guard back up the curving deck to the deserted main room. He took a seat at the molded table-bench arrangement, leaned his arm on the table, swallowed heavily. It was not all nausea from jump. He was terrified. "Make a man of you," he could hear his father saying. He seethed with misery. He was what he was, and he did not belong here, with the likes of Abe Blass and these grim, very same people. His father had made him expendable. If he were ambitious, he would try to make points for himself in these circumstances, ingratiate himself with Union. He did not. He knew his abilities and his limits, and he wanted Rosine, wanted his comforts, wanted the good drink he could not have with the drugs filling his system. It was not going to work, none of it, and they would snatch him Union side where everyone walked in step, and that would be the end of everything he knew. He feared changes. What he had at Pell was good enough. He had never asked much of life or of anyone, and the thought of being out here in the center of nothing at all gave him nightmares. But he had no choices. His father had seen to that. Blass came finally, sat down, and solemnly spread charts on the table and explained things to him as if he were someone of consequence to the mission. He looked at the diagram and tried to understand the premises of this shifting about through nothing, when he could not in fact understand where they were, which was essentially nowhere. "You should feel very confident," Blass said. "I assure you, you're in a far safer place than the station is right now." "You're a very high officer in Union," he said, "aren't you? They wouldn't send you like this otherwise." Blass shrugged. "Hummer and Swan's Eye. all the ships you've got near, pal?" Blass shrugged again. That was his answer. Chapter 6, Part 1. Maintenance Access White, 9-1042, 2100 hours. The men had come and gone for a long time, men in shells carrying guns. Satin shivered and tucked further back into the shadows by the cargo lift. They were many who had run when the Lucas directed, who had run again when the stranger men came, by the ways that the Hysa could use, the narrow ways, the dark tunnels where Hysa could breathe without masks and men could not. Men of the up above knew these ways, but they had not yet shown them to the strangers, and Hysa were safe, though some of them cried deep in the dark, deep, deep below, so that men would not hear. There was no hope here. Satin pursed her lips and sidled backward in a crouch, waited while the air changed, scampered back into safe darkness. Hands touched her. There was male scent. She hissed in reproof and smelt after the one who was hers. Arms folded her about. She laid her head wearily against a hard shoulder, comforting as she was comforted. Bluetooth offered her no questions. He knew that there was no better news, for he had said as much when she had insisted on going out to sea. It was trouble, bad trouble. Lucas spoke and gave orders, and strangers threatened. Old One was not here. None of the long-timers were, having gone somewhere about their own business, to the protection of important things, Satin reckoned. To duties ordered by important humans, and perhaps duties which regarded Hysa. But they had disobeyed, had not gone to the supervisors, no more than the Old Ones had gone, who also hated Lucas's. "Go back?" someone asked, finally. They would be in trouble if they turned themselves in after running. Men would be angry with them, and the men had guns. "No," she said. And when there was muttering to the contrary, Bluetooth turned his head to spit a surlier negative. "Think," he said. "We go there. Men can be there. Bad trouble." "Hungry," another protested. No one answered. Men might take their friendship from them for what they had done. They realized that clearly now. And without that friendship, they might be on down below always. Satin thought of the fields of down below, the soft clouds she had once thought solid enough to sit on, the rain and the blue sky and the gray-green-blue leaves, the flowers and soft mosses, most of all the air which smelled of home. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.